This is VOA News, Vera Max. I'm Laurel Bowman. Pope Francis arrived at the home of Iraq's top Shiite Muslim cleric in southern Iraq on Saturday for the first ever such meeting between the leaders of Roman Catholicism and Shiite Islam. Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani greeted Francis at his home in Najaf, the seat of Iraq's Shiite clergy, on the second day of the pontiff's historic tour of the country. In Syria, missile strikes on makeshift oil refineries in the northern part of the country killed 4 people and injured more than 20 others, a war monitor said Saturday. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said a series of strikes launched from Russian warships and by allied Syrian government forces hit the makeshift refineries in Aleppo province on Friday night, causing a massive blaze as dozens of tankers caught fire in the area controlled by Turkey and its Syrian rebel proxies. Oil installations in Turkey-controlled parts of Aleppo have come under repeated attack in recent months, although Moscow and the Syrian regime have not claimed responsibility. Syria's war has killed more than 387,000 people and displaced millions since starting in 2011 with a brutal repression of anti-government protests. It later evolved into a complex conflict involving jihadists and foreign powers. Northern neighbor Turkey has seized control of several regions inside Syria in military campaigns against the Islamic State group and Kurdish fighters since 2016. For more on these and other stories making international news headlines, we invite you to visit our website. That's voanews.com. This is VOA News. As Guinea grapples with a fresh Ebola outbreak, community resistance to measures needed to rein in the deadly virus is high, a top Red Cross official has warned. Guinea confirmed the disease was back in mid-February following first deaths the previous month. The West African country and international actors have reacted swiftly to stop the spread, isolating cases and treating them, tracking contacts, and launching a vaccination campaign. But the health chief at the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said reluctance within communities to go along with measures was an obstacle. He told AFP that the resistance was both community-based and religious-based, and not surprising since this deadly killer is very scary to people. Ebola is transmitted through close contact with bodily fluids. It causes severe fever and, in the worst cases, unstoppable bleeding. And death rates from Ebola are high, at around 50% on average of those infected, according to the World Health Organization. To date, in Guinea, and since February, 18 cases have been reported, 14 of which have been confirmed to be Ebola, including 4 people who have died, according to the WHO. These mark the first Ebola cases to surface in West Africa since a devastating 2013 through 2016 epidemic that left more than 11,000 people dead in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Vaccines and other therapies, though, have since become available. Rights groups have denounced Zimbabwean government plans to evict thousands of villagers from their communal land and convert it to industrial animal feed farming. More than 13,000 Shangani people, an indigenous minority group, were last month ordered to immediately vacate nearly 13,000 hectares of land in southeastern Zimbabwe. The legal notice said the land would be set aside for grass production unless the villagers acquired fresh occupation rights. Lawyers representing the community on Friday filed 2 urgent high court motions to have the eviction notice declared unconstitutional. Human Rights Watch said in a statement on Saturday that the Zimbabwean government should stop these evictions that would leave thousands of people destitute and vulnerable, especially in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. And Japan has extended a state of emergency in Tokyo by 2 weeks to try to combat COVID-19, even prompting a heartfelt apology by the prime minister. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
No, and I mean, there is no evidence whatsoever that Sonko has done a rape case or whatsoever. It has nothing to do with that. It's just that this government has totally decided to eliminate Sonko out of the course, and we all know why.
Senegalese protesters demand the release of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko.
Many of the international media are talking about it, but that's not our main concern. Our main concern is what the Chadian population are thinking about it, and that's what counts for us. The population is tired. They do not want Deby to be in power any longer.
A Chadian opposition party calls for an all-inclusive national dialogue before this year's elections.
What we are asking for, we want to put in place in a couple of months to come a transition government in place, and we welcome some of the people from his government to join us to put it in place. As it's going, we cannot allow it to go to the end.
An opponent of the Beninese government demand the immediate release of Rekia Madugu, the first female presidential candidate of a major political party. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Senegalese activist Ibrahim Samake says the arrest of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko shows he is a political threat to authorities. The 46-year-old Sonko is the leader of the opposition PASTEF party. He is accused of rape and currently under detention for disturbing public order. Samake and his mainly youthful supporters say the charges are politically motivated and aimed at preventing him from contesting the presidential elections scheduled for 2024. His supporters launched a series of protests in the capital, Dakar, that led to at least one person's death and calls for an independent inquiry. Ibrahim Samake is also a member of the Democratic Forces of Senegal. He tells me that there's growing evidence that authorities use trumped-up charges to disqualify any aspiring presidential candidate from competing in elections against incumbent President Macky Sall.
The protesters right now are very unhappy about the situation because the situation is actually from a long time. There's a history of injustice in Senegal. From like we have a government that is completely that has decided to shut down every prominent opposition leader that will go to face the current president on a fair competition to be elected democratically. So we have the case that happened to it, Karim Wade, that it went blank. And also, we had the case, also the same situation that went with Khalifa Sall. Today, the same president, the same government is doing the same thing towards Ousmane Sonko. But the particularity about Ousmane Sonko is Ousmane Sonko represents a new youth, a new generation. Those who actually realize that Senegal has been transformed to something new. So today, everybody is confused about the situation because they will do anything and they are ready to do anything for this president to understand that the rule of democracy has to be played fairly, that you cannot just destroy every opponent that is that stand for Senegal. That is the situation right now.
Some people are of the view that Mr. Sonko, Ousmane Sonko, is accused of rape. Doesn't he have to face the allegations in court?
We have a problem here. Sonko has been trapped. Because we all know Sonko is a prominent, is a leader. He will never go and do something like that. But this is, again, one of the schemes, one of the plans played by this government to eliminate a potential candidate. So this is the problem. Because we are facing, as I told you earlier, this government, he is like ready to do anything to destroy like opponents. Sonko is not guilty of it. And knowing the system that this government is doing to eliminate candidate. That's why, I mean, there is a fear that he will be trapped into something and put into jail.
Does that mean that opposition supporters, including you, will continue to protest at what you deem as injustice in spite of the fact that the man met the judges on Friday?
Well, the thing is, we will continue the fight until we find something clear, until we find something just for us to do it. I mean, even when he was, first of all, he was supposed to go to the court, but he said he couldn't, he didn't go at the first time because there was all of these the situation. But right now, when he decided to go to meet the judge, but he's been trapped by the same police, by the same government, for him to be able to put him into jail, because it was all clear he was going to see the judge. But on his way, there has been a lot of game where that has been played along the way to be able to catch him and to bring him to some other situation. That's the situation right now. If they only let him go, went to the judge, he was gonna be there, and there would be no problem for him to go to the judge and just finish with the situation, or find a way to continue this problem. But the problem is there is this power determined by any case, by any means, to put the man into jail. So that is the situation. So they will find any way. So that's the problem we are facing right now in Senegal.
Some people have denied that President Macky Sall want to run for a third term. And they have also denied that the charges against Ousmane Sonko are politically motivated. So why is the opposition, including yourself, accusing the government of politically targeting Mr. Ousmane Sonko?
If you follow the case of Karim Wade, if you follow the case of Khalifa Sall, I mean, at the beginning of this, I mean, there were 25 persons that were supposed to go, like, from the CREI. They only took one person out of it. It was Karim Wade. When they got Karim Wade out of the country, and they went after on and everybody, and they didn't, they stopped. Even some one of those people who were called by the CREI, some of them are actually working right now with the government. And also, when we finish with the case of Karim Wade, we went to Khalifa Sall, and you see what happened to Khalifa Sall. All this is politically motivated. If it wasn't politically motivated, of course Sonko were going to go like any citizen and go, because if you are called for rape, I mean, of course you have to answer to the judge. But the situation is not as it is. The situation is that this government is decided to take Sonko and take him into jail using some kind of some scheme, like saying that he has been raped. I mean, we all know, and I mean, there is no evidence whatsoever that Sonko has done a rape case or whatsoever. It has nothing to do with that. It's just that this government has totally decided to eliminate Sonko out of the course, and we all know why.
Abraham Samake is a member of the Democratic Forces of Senegal. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. In Chad, the opposition Transformers Party is calling for national dialogue and for the upcoming April 11 presidential election to be rescheduled. The party says only an all-inclusive dialogue with all stakeholders, including political parties and civil society groups, can resolve the tension. The opposition group also seeks the formation of an independent electoral body to organize elections in the West African country. It proposes that both the presidential and legislative polls be held simultaneously to save cost. The party's remarks come after the Supreme Court paved the way for incumbent President Idriss Deby to seek a sixth term of office. Analysts say lack of an alliance among opposition political parties makes it easier for the incumbent president to win re-election. Dr. Ndolembai Njesada Sadi is the vice president in charge of diaspora and bilateral relationships for the Transformers Party. He tells me that his party's calls are backed by top officials of the United Nations, who he says seek a political reset as part of the effort to restore democracy in Chad.
We have preached since day one of our inception the need of an inclusive dialogue for all the political leaders so that we can jointly bring the energy of the separation of power within the constitution and never talk about it ever again. And secondly, give Deby an honorable exit door so that after his departure, we should be able to hold a free and transparent legislative and presidential election coupled together. Because at the rate we are going right now, having the election in April and organizing the legislative later on, we do not even have the funding to organize the presidential as we speak. And on top of all of that, you may have known that on the 28th, one of the opposition leaders, Mr. Yaya Gilo, house got raided, and his mother and son and three other relative members got killed.
Does your party have the backing of other opposition parties for the cancellation of these elections that you are talking about? And do you think there's a major prospect that your calls for the cancellation, a national dialogue before the presidential and legislative elections are held jointly later on this year, would ever materialize?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things we said in 2018. And if you've been following the news, you have heard that the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, calling for the same thing we have been calling for since 3 years ago. Guterres has specifically said that we need to have a political and all-inclusive dialogue in order to reset the battle. So speaking of if other allies have, other political parties have rallied behind, they don't need to rally behind us. This is needed. It's an oxygen for the political situation within the country. We are talking about this cancellation in order to avoid a post-election crisis. We are already in pre-election crisis, and we do not want to carry that after the post-election crisis. As an example, we have over 200 of our members arrested the month of February alone for peaceful protest. So we do not want this to escalate, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, it's not, it doesn't matter if some political party are behind it or not, and you know how some of them are because they're being paid by the ruling party to support whatever is being dictated to them.
Some people are suggesting that it was because your presidential candidate failed to qualify for the election. That is why you are hell-bent on demanding the cancellation of the upcoming election for a national dialogue so you can have a seat at the table so your party will feel relevant in the democratic process in Chad. How do you respond to that?
You know, it's very sad that people are resigning all of this to one person, our candidate. This is not the issue. The issue is that 80% of the Chadians are under the age of 35 years old. And we cannot exclude 80% of the population and believing that only 20% of the population is able to lead this country. This is beyond our modest political party. This is a matter of the future of this country. This is a matter of developing this nation. This is a matter of turning away from dictatorship and looking toward democracy. It has nothing to do with who we are. We are the voice of the voiceless. And we're speaking out what many people are thinking low. And yes, they orchestrate this whole thing to disqualify us. But yet, we have all the legal basis to show that we are far from being disqualified because they know that we have the majority of the people behind us.
How popular is your call for the cancellation of the election and the organization or the demand for dialogue, an all-inclusive dialogue in Chad? How popular is this?
Of course, we believe in it. We know it's going to happen. Otherwise, there will be a huge post-electoral crisis, and we don't want to get down that rabbit hole. So how huge this this ideology is taking shape? As I said earlier, you listen to the UN speaking about it. Many of the international media are talking about it, but that's not our main concern. Our main concern is what the Chadian population are thinking about it, and that's what counts for us. The population is tired. They do not want Bibi to be in power any longer.
Dr. Ndolambai Njesad Asade is the Vice President in charge of Diaspora and Bilateral Relationships for the Transformers Party. He spoke with me from the Chadian capital in N'Djamena. In Benin, opposition parties are demanding the immediate release of Rekia Madugu, leader of the opposition party, the Democrats. Ms. Madugu, the first female presidential candidate for a major Beninese party, was arrested following a meeting with opposition figures in Porto-Novo Wednesday. She met with colleague opposition figures, including Moise Kereku, the son of former President Matthew Kereku, and Joel Aivo. She is accused of plotting to disrupt the upcoming elections and for funding a plot to murder an influential authority. Supporters of the opposition party reject the charges as politically motivated to intimidate and harass opponents of the administration. Madugu was disqualified for failing to meet requirements needed to contest in the presidential election. Ladislaw Prosper Agbesi is the founder of the New Congress Alliance and a former Benin presidential candidate. He tells me that the arrest of Ms. Madugu is yet another indication of the rapid erosion of the tenet of democracy under the president's leadership.
It is a plan to destroy the character of such a great leader like ourselves, Rika Madugu. She's a wonderful lady and never have a record of any criminality and run a government in our country and can never be part and parcel of any terrorist. Therefore, it is an act of sabotage from the government side to put such a kind of plot, such kind of act on her person. So we demand that she must be released immediately. We call up the international community to take all their responsibility to sanction the president, his government, for her release. I've made a statement this evening as the government, I give it to him till Thursday next week. If he doesn't release him, he will take our responsibility and release them.
At the press conference, the presidential candidate who failed to qualify for this year's election allegedly threatened the country's security, saying there will be no peace if her candidacy, or for that matter, her party is not allowed to participate in this election. Some people said that is threatening and that the government had no choice but to act.
I think that's not the real picture of what people can distort the statement of our colleagues in the opposition. And I never heard them say any such things in line of the election. What they are advocating is that you infringing into their rights of as a citizen of the country will bring instability in the country. They're talking to the government, what you are doing is wrong. We don't want you to continue acting like that because you are going to put a lot of instability. When you take the right of a citizen, instead of protecting them, you take away their right. What is the consequence of that? How many people can survive without their right? You are calling for insurrection in our country. That's the government who is doing that, not the opposition people. They are for peace. We are for peace. We are for peace in our country. Our country has been for many years the bastions of democracy, great democracy. So there's nowhere anybody of the opposition has ever spoke about those kind of languages.
What is your party and other opposition parties planning to do? Because some of these parties held a joint press conference where she spoke, but others are saying that if you threaten the country's peace, you threaten the country's stability, and you say that even if you are arrested, the fight will still go on. What does that mean? And she needed to explain herself. And one of the charges, I understand, is terrorism and plotting to cause chaos. The government had no choice than to act. What do you say to that?
They fomented this kind of allegation against them. What we are doing, as I'm the honorary chairman of my party, which is ANC, a new generation, and the movement of liberation, we are going to take our country back from a dictator. And we want the world to be aware that I will go back to the country soon and take back my country back from him.
What do you mean? What do you mean you are going to take back your country from him? Isn't he a Beninese? Wasn't he elected by the majority of Beninese to be the president?
As we stand today, he doesn't represent our people. He represents a danger. He represents insecurity. He represents all it is to be instability in our country. And the country is ready for us to take it away and make. We want peace and stability in the region. We don't want such a person who is a problem, a fear in our people in Benin. That is what we are going to do. And nothing is going to stop us to do it. Because we want the peaceful country we've had since 1990. And we won't want somebody who wants to stop anybody to have his rights, which is the fundamental to any individual in the country. We have a fundamental right.
Now, with what you are saying, some people might see it as a threat. However, some people are suggesting that why aren't all of you coming together to present a unified presidential candidate to have a shot at defeating the incumbent president, since all of you have the same goal anyway?
No, not really. You must know the genesis of what is happening in our country. We are the pioneer of democracy in the country. It's the country of our, the essence of our democracy is that everybody can compete and we choose the best. It doesn't spoil the soup. It doesn't spoil anybody. It is a joyful moment for us in our country where everybody is candidate. It's like a Christmas in our country. And when somebody comes and selected himself, select his own competitors, how do you call it a democracy? It's he has taken the right of people to express themselves away from them. He's done it through the municipality to parliamentary to everything, the election. He chooses, how can you choose your own people? So he has taken the right of people to express themselves. Benin election moment for so all the few decades I've been born is a period of celebration where we see people celebrating. Houses are talking about the candidate, just like in Ghana, how we celebrate it. This is what we see in Benin. But this is the first time we saw terror. We saw a type of terrorist, which is a Patrick Talon. He has agonized our country, and take away a piece of our country. What we are asking for, we want to put in place in a couple of months to come, a transition government in place, and we welcome some of these people from his government to join us to put it in place. As it's going, we cannot allow it to go to the end.
Ladislaw Prosper Agbesi is the founder of the New Congress Alliance and a former Benin presidential candidate. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Africa's year with the COVID-19 pandemic has been a challenging one, full of suspense and surprises. VOA's Anita Powell looks back at the continent's bout with the coronavirus, which has infected at least 2.8 million people and killed more than 72,000, according to the World Health Organization. She reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
In recent weeks, as Africa prepared to mark the grim milestone of 1 year since the coronavirus reached its shores, millions of long-awaited vaccines finally began to land across the continent. Most were provided by the global COVAX facility, which distributes vaccines to lower-income countries. That, officials say, has flipped this tale from one of despair to one of optimism. And, says South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, Africa had a hand in turning the tide.
South Africa's scientists and research institutions have made an important contribution to these efforts and have contributed to global knowledge about the disease, including on the emergence of new variants. And in this regard, our scientists, who we should be proud of, have really led the way and they are recognized globally.
Ramaphosa, who held the rotating head of the African Union in 2020, was also instrumental in establishing a continental plan to acquire vaccines. In Congo, the largest country in sub-Saharan Africa, officials this month received their first delivery of 1.7 million vaccines through COVAX. Village Reach, an aid organization that focuses on remote, rural, low-income countries, has been working to help that population. Their DRC country director, Freddy Nkosi, told VOA that while African nations appear to have a lower proportion of confirmed cases and deaths, the pandemic has still hit hard here.
Africa, yes, we are also affected as the rest of the world in different proportions, but we have to continue to protect ourselves through all the protective measures, but also we have to get vaccinated so that we are all protected.
Dr. Richard Lessels, one of South Africa's top viral researchers, says the continent's largest vaccine drive in South Africa looks promising after fits and starts. The country was set to distribute 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, but reversed course last month after researchers found it to be less effective against a variant that accounts for the majority of the nation's new cases. South Africa has since switched to the Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson vaccines, but the process still delayed the vaccination campaign. Lessel says that as the continent stares down this anniversary, it needs one thing, time.
I think only time will tell once we get beyond that first priority group of the healthcare workers and start delivering it to the other vulnerable groups within the population. We'll then get a much better sense of how we're doing here in South Africa.
So what is year two of the pandemic going to look like in Africa? On this, everyone seems to agree. Hopeful. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Uganda's Supreme Court has approved the withdrawal of the petition challenging the recent electoral victory of incumbent President Yoweri Museveni. The outcome of the presidential vote was challenged by Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, also known as Bobi Wine, the presidential candidate for the opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP. He alleged that the polls were characterized by a number of voter irregularities. Wine, however, changed his mind, saying he will not receive a fair hearing at the Supreme Court. Critics say he wasted the time and resources of the court. They also accuse him of tarnishing the reputation of the court, saying his claims of biased rulings undermine the independence of the judiciary. Godbertu Mushabe is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist. He tells me that the withdrawal of the challenge against the outcome of the vote is a disappointment to President Museveni and his supporters. He adds that they will not benefit from the validation of his victory by the country's highest court.
Anybody who has watched Ugandan politics and the Ugandan judiciary would know that the Supreme Court cannot dispense justice in a case where President Museveni is involved. Because President Museveni has been in power for the last 35 years, and he has literally appointed every judge on the Supreme Court and in any other lower courts of the country. But most importantly, in the event that you don't expect justice, which I think the Robert Kyagulanyi's lawyers could understand, the best political action was actually to withdraw the case from court. And the moment Robert Kyagulanyi petitioned to withdraw the case, I don't think that the Supreme Court had any option other than allowing the withdrawal of the petition.
So where does this leave the challenge of the authenticity or credibility of the victory of President Yoweri Museveni?
My view is that it leaves it where it was. First of all, this was a very illegitimate election conducted, characterized by excessive violence, where the incumbent president Museveni used COVID-19 as an instrument to deny his opponents the opportunity to campaign and look for votes. As we speak now, there are more than 100 people who were killed during the elections or in the process of the campaign. Close 200 people that are reported missing, or they are being held in military facilities across the country without trial. There are also people who have been arrested and tortured by the military. So, in effect, you have an election that was a total fraud, and therefore, any outcome of this election, in my view, would be considered illegitimate. And I think the withdrawal of the court petition by Robert Kyagulanyi is a good political statement because it denies President Museveni the stamp of approval from the Supreme Court.
People who voted for incumbent President Yoweri Museveni are of the view that he won the election legitimately because in the rural areas, majority of the people overwhelmingly voted for him, and that probably Robert Kyagulanyi was popular in some city centers, and that was all. What are your thoughts?
Peter, I come from rural Western Uganda. I come from a constituency called Ruhama East, and I spent there a whole week moving around and talking to people. And in all the 10 polling stations in this constituency, by 11 a.m., the regime had picked all the ballot papers. My 76-year-old mother went to the polling station to vote at about midday, and she was told that they had voted for her. All these stories are echoed by almost so many people across the country.
Where does the opposition NUP, the National Unity Party, go from here, looking at the fact that the Supreme Court has agreed that they can withdraw the presidential petition they filed challenging the victory of Museveni as the legitimately elected president of Uganda? Where does this party go from here?
I don't think that the party would go anywhere, because you see, what your listeners probably need to understand is that the Ugandan problem, the problem of elections and politics in Uganda is not a legal problem. and therefore the Supreme Court or any other court cannot offer a solution, because courts are judicial forums for determining legal issues or issues applying the laws. The Ugandan problem is not a legal problem. It's a political problem. And it's a problem that will not be solved by election, because the electoral system is already distorted and biased in favor of a man who has been in power for 35 years. So the Ugandan problem will be solved through as a political problem. We have to find a political solution. Myself and many other people have argued and really worked towards having a national dialogue that brings together all Ugandans in their different formations to talk about the future of the country and a future agenda that creates shared prosperity. But to the extent that President Museveni is in charge and that he wants to die in power, which he definitely is working toward, then you cannot expect that you would get justice from courts of law in Uganda. All our problems that we are dealing with have to be addressed as political problems, and we have to find political solutions to them.
Godbert Tumushabe is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Zimbabwe says it has started preparing for a bumper harvest, the country's first in two decades. But aid agencies say they will need to ensure about 4 million people have enough food, especially in urban areas where business has been hurt by the COVID-19 lockdown. For VOA Colombo's Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Zimbabwe's government says above rainfall levels and conservation agriculture are bearing fruits for the country, which for many years has largely depended on humanitarian aid. Information Minister Monica Mtshangwa this week said that, according to the Minister of Agriculture, Zimbabwe will produce 2.8 million tons of corn, the country's staple crop, against a target of 1.8 million tons needed for consumption. She said the government is getting equipment in place to handle the harvest.
Regarding the supply of combined harvesters for the efficient and timeous harvesting of grain, an additional 72 and 21 combined harvesters from the John Deere facility and the Belarus program will be mobilized respectively. Government is also mobilizing internal capacity for combined harvesting through the repair of 25 non-functional combines, which are owned by institutions and individuals. In the same vein, the ministry is importing an additional 13 mobile grain dryers from Italy.
When the harvest comes in, it should drive down the cost of food around the country. But that does not fix everything for Zimbabweans in urban areas struggling to make a living. About 40 kilometers away from where Mtshangwa spoke is Epworth, one of the poorest suburbs in Zimbabwe. Then, 48-year-old widow Caroline Chanyaruka is enrolled in the World Food Program's Urban Resilience Program, which helps people launch income-generating projects. She now makes mushrooms from bio-waste. She eats them and sells the surplus to look after her 7 children. Hunger is such a terrible thing, she says. It's worse for a widow like me. For school fees, food and everything, the children look up to me. So it's difficult for a woman to do it alone. This WFP program has helped me during these lockdown periods. It also helped my children as they somewhat get occupied with watering the mushrooms. They now have something to do even in the future, says Chanyaruka. Claire Neville is the spokeswoman of the WFP in Zimbabwe. She says Chanyaruka is one of more than 500,000 Ebenites the UN agency is trying to help be food secure in the wake of the COVID-19 lockdowns and Zimbabwe's moribund economy. Others receive cash handouts of $12 each.
This cash assistance has proved a lifeline for thousands of Zimbabweans right now and has allowed WFP to remain agile to the changing context in Zimbabwe. The outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated Zimbabwe's economic instability and has had a devastating effect on urban residents, many of whom were living hand-to-mouth, working multiple jobs in the urban sector.
But never as the WFP is facing a funding gap of around $45 million. She says with more funding, the WFP can reach millions of Zimbabweans affected by the pandemic and the lagging economy. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
The UN Human Rights Office is condemning Algeria's crackdown on members of the pro-democracy Hirak movement and is calling on the authorities to end its violence against peaceful protesters. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Nationwide street protests have resumed in recent weeks, defying COVID-19 restrictions. UN rights officials denounce the violent response by Algerian security forces, who they accuse of using unnecessary or excessive force and arbitrary arrests to suppress peaceful demonstrations. UN human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says Algerian authorities are reacting to the protesters in the same repressive manner seen in 2019. And 2020.
These developments echoed what happened earlier in 2019 and 2020, during which a total of at least 2,500 people were arrested or detained in connection with their peaceful activism. Similarly, the criminal prosecution in 2019 and 2020 of activists, human rights defenders, students, journalists, bloggers, and ordinary citizens expressing dissent continued during the first 2 months of this year.
The installation by Algeria's top generals of Abdelmadjid Tebboune as the country's new president in December 2019 sparked widespread outrage and protests by the pro-democracy Hirak movement. Colville says the Algerian Penal Code is being used to restrict freedoms of expression and to prosecute people for expressing dissenting opinions. He says his office has received credible reports some 1,000 people have been prosecuted for participating in the Hirak movement or for posting messages online critical of the government.
According to the same reports, at least 32 people are currently detained for the legitimate exercise of their human rights, and some of them face lengthy sentences while others are still in pretrial detention. We have also received allegations of torture and ill treatment in detention, including sexual violence.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling upon Algerian authorities to stop using violence against peaceful protesters and to immediately release all those arbitrarily arrested. It also is calling for a prompt, impartial, and effective investigation into allegations of torture and ill treatment in detention and to bring those responsible for these crimes to account. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Oga fluffy senti sinan meruti tandale. Meshindwa kulipa bima, nimeuza madale. Radio nyimbo mezima, TV ndio hatare. Meneja umebaki jina, nitakia tatale. Ole shabiki zangu. Waloni sifu kwa maneno matamu. Leo mati zangu ni mitusi tu kwa Instagramu. Kimwa na statangu eti naya nifamu. Hata mwona ize kimpigia ananifukia kama salamu. Na magazeti nyumbani kwa kuku sabari sunajuaga. Utasikia tafarani timoni kwa zari amemwagwa. Na vinye nilivyo nyonge tabia ya kwa jibu.
Wiley's Bolivar. sina mengi ila naweza sema asante kwa Mwenyezi Mungu namuomba sana.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the speaker of truth has no friends. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.